Okay, so the title of my talk is Celebrating the Dharma, The Voice of the Buddha. Okay. And I just hope so far you've enjoyed coming to the peace and quiet of the countryside. I would have said that if the combine harvester hadn't turned up in the field next door. That's life in the country. It's about once in a year's event, and I've just happened to do it while we're here. So anyway, it's quiet in here. So I'm going to talk actually about the need, the requirement, the practice, in a way, of quietness, both internally and externally, and how that relates to, in a way, our relationship with the Dharma. Okay. So the Dharma is, if you like, the teachings of Buddhism, okay, founded on the original teachings of the Buddha. So, celebrating the Dharma, the voice of the Buddha. So, as I said, it's relatively quiet here, possibly quieter than Herne Hill on a Wednesday night, I don't know. But it's relatively quiet here, so we can listen. So if we listen, well, I'm asking us to think about listening this weekend. So what are we listening to? Well, I think something or someone is trying to communicate to us, across time, across space, across cultures, from another dimension altogether, if you like. Okay. So I thought that reminded me of the search for other life in the universe, etc., that modern astronomy is obviously quite gripped by. So maybe it's a bit like that, but not quite like that. I know to do that, quiet is needed in all kinds of ways, and a stable basis and a sort of silence that enables you to pick up very subtle, very distant signals. So maybe it's a little bit like that, but not exactly like that. So I'm asking us to think in terms of just listening this weekend, listening to a communication. So to go into that more further, we need to go back 2,500 years. Okay. 2,500 years ago, if you like, a new type of consciousness came into being. Using that way of explaining, actually, I'm indebted to Subhuti, for anyone who's heard a recent talk of his. So I pay my honour, my debts to Subhuti. But it's a good way of thinking about it. 2,500 years ago, in northeast India, a totally new, radically new type of consciousness arose. It was a consciousness that was fully awake. That consciousness saw quite clearly sort of how reality is, the nature of reality, and also how it works, what goes into the operations of reality. That consciousness was also, because of that, free of our ideas that the universe, in fact, revolves around me. Okay. Not around you, but around me. That consciousness was free of wanting things, trying to get things. Free of not wanting things, trying to get rid of things. And because it was free of all that activity, if you like, an enormous amount of energy was freed. So that consciousness, that energy, kind of went into, or was expressed in terms of compassion and understanding, wisdom. So this new type of consciousness that came into being, for want of a better word, because as I'm going to go on to say, it's actually quite difficult to define and pin down, for the want of a better word, we call enlightenment. Okay. And someone in northeast India at the time, whose name before was Siddhartha Gautama, okay, for the want of a better label, we now know as the Buddha. The Buddha, the awakened one. And we'll find out that his attempts at communicating from that quality of consciousness, trying and communicating ways to help us experience that for ourselves, those attempts at communication, we call, for a better word, Dharma. Okay, the teachings of the Buddha. So traditionally, the Dharma was known as Buddha Vacca, the Buddha's voice, if you like. So it's the voice of the Buddha. So it's that voice of the Buddha which is still trying to communicate with us over 2,500 years, over the sort of half the planet, from a totally different culture. And in a way, more importantly, from a very different sort of dimension of being and consciousness and way of experiencing the world. And that's what we're celebrating this weekend, and that's what this talk celebrates. And hopefully not celebrating by also ourselves listening in all kinds of ways. Listening in a, don't take that necessarily too literally, but listening out for this message. So 2,500 years ago, the Buddha, through his own efforts, broke through to this new level, this new type of consciousness. From that way of being, if you like, he saw that in it, and he had the answers to the most pressing problems of humanity, of life itself, really. All the questions about suffering and life and death, the big existential problems, he saw the answers were all, in a way, in that experience of this new type of consciousness of enlightenment. He also felt, and it seemed to go with it, almost sort of automatically as part of it, he also felt the imperative to actually communicate from that and to help others. And then he found that this created a problem, a conundrum, if you like. Because this enlightened consciousness that he was now kind of, don't quite know what words to use anyway, was the consciousness he was expressing and part of, that has no way of being and has no sort of fixed idea or sense of a self at the centre of it that everything refers to, everything had opened out. Well, this is so totally against the norm of how we normally experience the world. Okay? We are hardwired and soft programmed to see the world as, in terms of there's me here and there's everything else out there, that there's a self and there's this other out there. But that, the Buddha saw, as not actually being absolutely true. It might be relatively true and a useful way of experiencing things, but it wasn't actually the way things were. It wasn't actually the experience that he was having. And he could see that his experience was the truthful experience. So it's said that at first he found, well, he was struggling with the idea of, well, how to communicate this. And he felt this sort of great urge, imperative to communicate. But he could see how difficult that would be for all kinds of reasons. A quote, according to the ancient scriptures, what he said, this is him later telling his other followers what the experience was like for him at that time. He said, "I felt that now I have gained the Dharma, the truth, profound, hard to understand, hard to perceive, hard to know, tranquil, transcendent, beyond the sphere of reasoning, subtle, to be known only by the wise. So he could see that it was a very subtle, very difficult to understand, and in fact through his own experience a very difficult sort of state of consciousness to actually arrive at. Okay, so that was the first problem. Plus he realised that this experience goes beyond words and concepts, as we're going to look at in a minute. Words and concepts and ideas and thinking about things in terms of concepts, rational thought, is actually an essential part of our hard wiring. But actually, this experience went way beyond that. Okay. And the other obstacle the Buddha saw to communicating it and helping others achieve it was, if you like, us, the rest of us, everyone else. Because he went on to say that at the time he pondered, well, mankind is intent on its attachments and its cravings and its hatreds, and takes delight and pleasure in them. For mankind intent in this way, it's hard to see this truth, namely conditionality, origination by way of cause. I'll explain that in a minute. We'll try to. So he saw right away that it was going to be extremely difficult to communicate this. And at first he thought, it's not going to be possible. And then, traditionally it's said that, if you like, a voice from a higher state of being of his own consciousness, it's one way of looking at it, or a deva, a sort of a member of the god realm, a celestial being, appeared to him and started talking to him. And the gist of this, his name traditionally is called Brahma Sahampati. The gist of his message was, look, there are beings, there are people, and the phrase is, with little dust in their eyes, they will be able to see the truth. Okay, you must teach, how else will they be saved? So the Buddha contemplated this apparently and realized it was true, had a vision of a familiar vision in traditional Buddhism of the world and people in it like lotuses. Some lotuses are in the mud under the water. Other lotuses are sort of opening at the surface. And other lotuses, as lotuses do, are rising up on their stalks out of the water and flowering fully. And he saw this just simply as an image, if you like, of the whole range of spiritual receptivity and openness that there is in the world. And he decided that he would take the challenge up. He would attempt to communicate it. So he set off after quite a while, a few days, a week, it said traditionally, just sort of sitting in his experience of this new consciousness, in his enlightened consciousness, and he set out to try and communicate it to others. So he had the idea of finding some companions of his. He'd been with them on quite a long and arduous spiritual journey, where they'd been practicing all kinds of ascetic practices, the kind of things that were very fashionable in the spiritual world in India in those days, starving themselves, you know, and sort of sticking things in themselves and hanging themselves upside down. It was thought that that was the way, by mortifying and restricting the body, that the spirit could flower. The Buddha had realised that this was not the way. This was not the way to the freedom of suffering. It was just increasing it. So he had left these previous companions. It said there was five of them. Gone off and by himself had attained enlightenment. But he thought he'd go back to those companions first. So we can picture the scene. He kind of wandered around, probably knew where they were, found them. And apparently, you can imagine, these guys weren't very impressed when they saw him coming up to them. You know, he had given up on all these tough practices that you had to do, that the real spiritual practitioner would do. So they probably thought of him as a bit of a wimp, and he had copped out and just wandered off. So he had probably had a bit of a job just to sort of get them to, to meet him and take him seriously. But something about the way he was, the way perhaps his bearing, his character that was coming across, seemed to impress them. So in the end, he got them to sit down with him and start talking to them, trying to really communicate his experience to them and see if he could find a way of helping them to attain the same experience. But can you need to picture it, really? I mean, the thing is that he was coming from an experience that was so totally different from our normal experience. How do you communicate something when there isn't that shared experience? You know, it's like someone coming from a totally different planet where there's, I don't know, colours and forms that we just don't see here. So it took an effort on his part. I can imagine him them sitting around, and actually for days and days and days, possibly even longer, just trying to get through to them, talking to them, persuading them. First of all, telling them, look, I think the way you're doing it, I don't think it's going to get you anywhere. Why don't you try this? I've found this works. And then talking to them. Perhaps using ingenuity, trying to find different ways of talking to them. Trying trial and error. He might have said, well, look, try this. And does that work? No? Okay, well, try that. Okay, they might say, well, is it like this? And you'd have to say, well, no, it's not like that. Maybe it's a bit like this, but it's not that. It's more like this. And you could imagine this sort of backwards and forwards attempt to communicate something that was totally new to someone else. What helped him in that, I think, which is an important point to just take in, on board, is that it would seem that he had, because of the clarity of his vision, he had quite a profound ability to sort of really see who it was he was talking to. So, you know, he could really take people in. And he seemed to have developed during his teaching career that ability to see what exactly that person might need to get through to, you know, what would make them think, what would make them sort of see things in a different way. So he had that advantage, if you like. So apparently this went on for quite some time, and then suddenly one of them got it, okay? Apparently one of them broke through. Eventually one of them, whose name is Cardinia, awoke, almost like suddenly awoke. Well, yes, that's how it is. Awoke to this whole new way of seeing the world. And the Buddha, it's said traditionally, shouted out, well, I don't know if he shouted, he might have said it very emphatically, Cardinia knows, Cardinia knows. So I don't know whether he slid on his knees towards the corner flag, you know, and waited for all his teammates to pop on. But it might have been something like that, you know, a complete joy of, you know, if you like, scoring a goal in this case, yeah? Cardinia knows. So the Buddha realized the significance of that. And in fact, that significance is, you know, a cosmic universal significance. That Buddha's breakthrough to this new type of consciousness is of the greatest significance. And as Buddhists, we believe it's the greatest significance in the universe, certainly in the human universe, if you like, the possibility opening up of a whole new way of being in the world, not dominated by greed, hatred, and delusion, but perhaps dominated by love, generosity, and wisdom. So the Buddhist breakthrough is a great universal significance, we would believe as Buddhists. But in a way, Cardinia's breakthrough was almost as significant in a way. What this meant is that it could be communicated. Okay? If that hadn't been the case, then the Buddha would have lived and died, and you know what he had attained, what he had managed to achieve, would have died with him. But it was communicated. And with that communication, the Dharma came into being. That was the first teaching, if you like, the first communication of the truth as seen by an enlightened consciousness. And actually, the Sangha came into being as well. There was only two of them at that point, but in a way, there was a collective of two to start with, of a shared way of looking at the world, a shared orientation. So, in Buddhist terms, the three jewels arose in the world. The Buddha was there, but then the Dharma and the Sangha. So, for 40 years after that event, the Buddha dedicated his life to helping others, you know, see and then attain this same vision, if you like. And then after Kundinya got it, apparently one by one, the other four of those original companions that he was teaching, if you like, got it as well. And then many others over 40 years period, the Buddha was able to help to see the world in the same way. And what he did, those teachings, those communications, at first, for possibly as much as a couple of hundred years, were just remembered and passed down in an oral tradition. So the Dharma, the teachings, if you like, was an oral one for quite a while. And then bit by bit, over hundreds of years, actually, they would be written down and then come to us in terms of the scriptures and books and teachings. So down from the Buddha onwards, his followers and disciples who attained the same enlightenment, and down through the centuries, really, others who had attained to that same state, have done the same, have given themselves to the challenge of communicating the truth. But of course, communication needs a form, really. It needs a medium. It'll need words. I'm trying to use words here. It'll use symbols, forms, metaphors. It needs to use some form to communicate, you know, from one person to another, even if that person is an enlightened person to an unenlightened person. But I'll point out just now that the essence of that truth that's being communicated, the message, if you like, the experience, the gist of the experience is always the same. I'm just going to read a very short quote now. So if it puzzles you, don't worry. We might explore it a little bit tomorrow, but just see let it in, really. It's said that the very gist of the Buddha's teaching was that this being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not becoming, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. That's the sort of shrunk down almost to the kernel of the Buddha's teaching. I might say something about that in a minute. If I don't have time, we'll explore that a bit more tomorrow. So that's the simplest expression of Pratichasamutpada, which translated to English as conditionality or conditional co-production. It's basically saying that everything is dependent on everything else, really. Perhaps that's the simplest way I can put it. Nothing actually, including us, exists as and for just ourselves. Anyway, leave that with you for now. So from the Buddha trying to get across to those first few companions, right down through the centuries, really the Dharma, the teachings and the teachers of Buddhism, have tried one way or the other to get through, to put the message across, to have that effect. So you'll find that's an explanation why if you look at the whole range of Buddhist teachings, they're just so varied, and some of them almost seem to contradict others, as we'll see in a minute. At times, rational argument is used. At times, just be practical advice. Well, just do this, and you'll find out for yourself. inspiring poetry, colourful imagery, symbolism, ritual, parables, and exemplification as well, and probably many other ways. It's almost like trying different ways to get through, to put this very hard to communicate message through to us or different people. So it's trying to affect our thinking, trying to spark our imaginations, trying to awaken our intuitions, to get through to us, to get through to you. Okay. So what will turn the way you see on the world on its head? Okay. Sometimes the Dharma wields a stick. Okay. Sometimes it waves a big, beautiful carrot, you know, to get you to move in a way. So what it's trying to get us to do is to go beyond, move beyond our normal habitual ways of thinking and seeing the world. And it'll use anything it thinks of, if you like, if I can put it like that. Sometimes the Dharma will just argue with our habitual ways of thinking and carry on arguing till they collapse. And we have to find another way of thinking and seeing things. So the first teaching, traditionally it's said, that the Buddha gave to his four companions is one of the fundamental teachings. It's the Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha was basically saying, look, there's suffering, there's lots of other things, but we are, as human beings, particularly concerned with suffering and how to alleviate it or go beyond it. But because of conditionality, there's always a reason for suffering. There's always conditions that lie behind our experience of suffering. So if some of those conditions cease, the suffering will cease. And there is a way, there is a path, the Noble Eightfold Path, which is a series of steps you can take to lead to that ceasing of suffering. So that was, in a way, in a nutshell, his first teaching. I'll just very briefly, another way of teaching a parable. I'll just briefly mention a parable of the burning house, which comes from the White Lotus Sutra, a very traditional Buddhist series of texts, really. In this parable, use our imaginations on this, there's a wealthy man who's got a family of many children. Okay, so he's got a big house, children, you know, kind of very well looked after. They have lots of toys to play with. They're in the house playing with their toys. The father's outside the house. Father sees that the house is burning. There's a fire started. The children are in danger. Okay, so of course his first one, he needs to get the children out. So he stands this side of the flames and shouts to them, children, come out, the house is burning. But of course the children are so intent and absorbed in playing with their toys, they don't hear him. Or perhaps they hear him and then go back to their toys again. So he's in desperate straits, how to get the children out. So he comes up with a plan. Instead of shouting, come out, the house is burning, he says, come out. I've got all these wonderful toys out here for you to play with. They're much better than the ones you've got in the house. And that does the trick. The kids all come running out, excited to play with these toys. And then it said, actually, what he has got to give them when they get out of the house are toys and things that are so much more wonderful than the toys they were imagining that drew them out. Okay, so I'll leave it there, really. Very simple parable, and you can let your imagination just play on that. The Dharma's like that. There's the stick. Your house is burning. You're in trouble. Get out. And there's the carrot. If you come out, there's all these wonderful things out here, if you like. Okay. So I'll just mention, for now, just one other sort of form of communication. Apparently, at some point in his teaching career, the Buddha just did one thing. He had a lot of people he was trying to communicate with, get them to understand the Dharma. And at one point, he just held up a flower. And it said that there was one person there, one of his disciples, who got the communication and broke through to this new way of seeing. How is that possible? It's a mystery. But in a way, one way we could look at that is that actually, apart from all the teachings, in a way, nature itself is, well, more than trying to communicate to us. He's shouting at us. It's saying, look, you know, bring what your understanding so far, bring it, look, listen and reflect on me, the flower, the tree, whatever it is, you know, the wheelbarrow. Reflect on my true nature, because I am real. Okay, I, in fact, only exist because of the truth of conditionality. So the true nature of things, reality, with a capital R, is always present if we are open and receptive to it. So in a way, the teachings, if we're subtle and listen to them, are coming to us from everywhere, all the time. So this communication of Buddhism, of the Dharma, as I said, is trying in a way to just push one essential message through to us. But it has to use, and the teachers and the other forms have had to use, our language, our terms, images that we can relate to. And then pushes them to the limits, you could say, because the truth goes beyond them, but it's pointing to them or trying to push us towards it, towards the truth. You know, the Dharma books in the bookshop there, the books on Buddhism, aren't the Dharma, okay? Me talking here isn't the Dharma. Like a loudspeaker in a radio, if you like, isn't the music. And the window isn't the landscape beyond the window. None of these things are the Dharma themselves in the sense of the Dharma as the truth. They are the means for us to apprehend the truth. Okay, so that's what the Buddha was trying to do, if you like. That's what Buddhist teachers down through the ages are trying to do. That's what the world out there is trying to do. Okay? When we come up against something, say something extreme like death, it doesn't fit. Death does not fit our view of things. It seems strange. How do we relate to death? How do we make sense of death? There you've got someone you're very close to, you care about. One minute, if you like, they're alive. The next minute, what's happened? You know, it's a mystery, if you like. In a way, that is reality. That is the truth communicating to us at that point. It's saying your view of things, the world that you've constructed and you live by isn't big enough. It's not big enough to contain the reality of death. So reality is there all the time in different ways, trying to communicate with us in that way. So that's from the other side, but we have a part to play in all this. We're not just passive. If you like, it's we have our side of the deal to meet. We have our part to fulfil in this communication, like any communication. Okay, there's talking and there's listening, isn't there, in a communication? And both those things are equally important. And in a communication, it can move backwards and forwards. So maybe our challenge is, or one of our challenges is listening. So that's where I come back to the beginning of the talk. If there's this subtle, almost distant message coming through to us, are we tuning into it? Are we listening? Are we too busy talking or running around? You know, just sort of trying to be busy and doing our thing. Are we tuning in subtly enough? Are we tuning in to Dharma Radio? I remember as a kid, most of you are too young to know, so I remember pirate radio back in my teenage years and being broadcast from somewhere in the middle of the English Channel or something, and all these other radio stations, and under the bedclothes when I'm supposed to have gone to bed, tuning into Radio Luxembourg or something, and having to get very you know, amidst all the static and the interference in the other channels, just trying to get that one that I wanted to listen to. And you'd often lose it, but you'd have to tune very carefully. I think with digital radio, it's all much more automatic and easier now. But it's a bit like that. Are we tuning into Dharma radio station? Other stations might sound very loud and very attractive and superficially similar sometimes. Okay. How can we tell the difference? Well, that's a question I'll just have to leave hanging for now. Possibly something we can we could discuss and think about later. How do we know it's the Dharma we're listening to and not something else? And are we finding ourselves ways of, well, just clearing gently that dust from our eyes that the Buddha's initial sort of vision told him? We are all here. That would mean, in the grand scale of things, we might come into that category of beings with little dust in our eyes. We've got less dust in our eyes. That means we can see a little bit more clearly. If we didn't, at some point, even though we can't see the answers, we've all seen the question clearly enough to come here, yeah, this weekend. So that's worth reflecting on. And that's why, as Buddhists, we practice. That's our tuning into Dharma radio station. That's our practice. That's why we practice. And that's why the Buddha and the Buddhist tradition have taught and continue to teach all these practices that we do and we talk about, starting significantly with the practice of ethics and the precepts. In order to quieten down enough and have the right conditions to hear something that's quite subtle, our minds need to be quiet. If we want our minds to be quiet, our bodies have got to be quiet. Our lives, in a way, have to quieten down. If we're caught up in anger and jealousy and dissatisfaction and unmindfulness, we won't hear the subtle signal. Other practices, all the practices we do, Sangha practices, just engaging with other Buddhists, talking about the Dharma, sharing experience. Meditation practices, mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, sadhana practice, mantra chanting, rituals, right livelihood, Dharma study, everything. In a way, true Buddhist sense, that's why we do all those things, so that we can pick up and we can be in communication with the message that comes coming from the Buddha down through the centuries. To still our self-referential busyness, if you like. And to try and take in a bigger perspective that's just not dominated by our own habitual ways of doing things and thinking. That's why we go on retreat. That's why Vajrasana's here. Think of Vajrasana as a high-tech receiving station, you know, that's providing all the conditions for distant signals. That's why the stupa's there, you see. So it's actually got some very sophisticated electronics inside. No, it hasn't, actually. So Vajrasana is a receiving station for the Dharma, okay? We've tried to create the environment here that just encourages quietening, settling, being with yourself, being still, listening. And it's very good at that, as I said, except when the combine harvester's next door. So our challenge is to listen. But listen externally, listen to teachings, listen to the Dharma, read the Dharma, talk to other Buddhists, if you like, look at the world and reflect on it around us. But also listen inside as well, to ourselves. And that's, you know, primarily why we meditate. That's what we're ideally doing when we meditate. We're also listening to the message that's in us as well. It's a bit like Amarapushpa said, that stream, in a way, the spring is a fountain that's within in us as well as something that's outside of us. So our challenge is to listen outside and inside. And then maybe just notice the correspondences, notice the are, where what's outside and what's inside seem to agree in some maybe mysterious way. Okay. So, and reflect on what we hear. And not just take the Dharma at its face value, okay? Remember the Buddha, you probably heard this before, most of you. The Buddha said, don't believe what I tell you. Try it for yourself, if you like. Well, that's a rough idea, gist of what he said. Suck it and see, if you like. They probably use those terms. So not many founders of major world religions have said, don't believe me, have they? But, you know, Buddhism's different in that. The Buddha's saying, try this, try that. Does it work? So, we try it. And we neither agree unthinkingly, that's one way, to what we hear, but nor do we just reject, knee-jerkingly, if you like. So with neither agreeing nor rejecting, maybe when we're engaged in Buddhist practice, just look within for that sort of quieter, deeper, positive response to what we're hearing. Not just saying, oh yes, that must be true, or oh no, that's nonsense, or somewhere in the spectrum between those two. And we listen to what we listen, and we try it out. We turn it over, we reflect on it, okay, when we're practicing Buddhism, ideally. We turn it over in our minds. We try it out, test it. Does it work? Is this working? And we can see if the practice is helping us, maybe just a little bit. Maybe it's helping us become a little bit more content. Maybe it's been making us become a little less selfish. Sometimes these things are easier for someone else, a friend to spot, than we do ourselves. Do we see ourselves and others just that little bit more clearly, with more understanding? Have we just got a better sense of what's going on? Are we less confused in our lives? So if we notice that happening, okay, then our faith in the Dharma grows, and that's what Buddhist faith means. It's also based on, it's an intuitive response, but it's also based on trying things out and they work. So then, okay, if that works, okay, so I'll take it further. So what the Dharma is trying to show us, what the Dharma is trying to communicate to us, will therefore become just a little bit by little bit more naturally the way we see things. And in fact, we'll become more who we truly are. Okay. And then the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, the voice of the Buddha might start to work through us. And we'll have made contact, if you like, with that other dimension out there in space, and realise that it's not just over there on the other side of the galaxy, if you like. It's in the world around us, and it's in us too. And we might realise actually there is ultimately no difference between the two things. And make no mistake, every shift, little shift we make in our, you know, in our positivity, in our metta, in our awareness, in our kindness, in our understanding, is significant. So every time we make a little shift, the whole universe might shout, someone, Sangajata, knows a little bit more than she did before. And then eventually, the universe might shout, Bill knows. And then Bill, as he always likes to do, can slide on his knees to the corner flag. Bill's a footballer. So we're engaged in listening with the Dharma, in allowing it to influence us and our lives. We're engaged with something of universal cosmic significance, actually. And that's quite a thing to take on board. So I'm dedicating, that's the end of the talk, but I'm dedicating it to, again, Sangharakshita, our teacher and the founder of Sri Ratna. Okay. and the other Buddhist teachers down through the ages, and the, back to the Buddha himself. All I'm doing here, and all we can ever do, is just try to pass as best we can in our own small ways, try to pass on the message, try to just bring a little echo of Buddha Vacca into our lives, into the word of the Buddha into our lives. So I'm just going to finish with a quote from Sangharakshita, from the Survey of Buddhism, which I think expresses the kind of universal significance and the grandness, if you like, of what it is we're engaged with. So he said, "The hallmark of Buddhist teaching is universality. So its external forms may change, and one formulation of Buddhism will succeed another over the ages. But these are only adaptations to the various cultural and social expressions of a common human need. Beneath all such changes, the Dharma remains unchanged, not as a fossil, but as an inexhaustible fountain of spiritual life. For it is based not on the accidents, but upon the essentials of existence, upon a truth that has outlived even the existence of universes, being in its widest sense identical with that very principle, Pratichasamutpada, which renders the origin and dissolution of universes possible."